KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A signing ceremony is expected to take place next week for two national monuments in California, which include tribal cultural and sacred sites. The White House announced the designations Tuesday, and an event was to take place in the state but was postponed due to high winds. Congressman Raul Ruiz, whose district includes parts of the 624,000-acre Chuckwalla National Monument, says the lands will now be protected from development.
This is one of these unique examples where you have both the conservation and tribal leaders, as well as the renewable energy and utility companies, all endorsing this enormous monument.
The area south of Joshua Tree National Park is also habitat for the Chuckwalla lizard, bighorn sheep, and the endangered desert tortoise. Thomas Torres is former chair of the Torres Martinez Band of Cahuilla Indians.
The next step is to strategically develop a co-stewardship plan, put all those resources together, and then start to protect the land.
The White House also intends to designate a new national monument near Shasta Lake in Northern California. Brandy McDaniels with the Pitt River Tribe says they've been fighting development in the area for decades.
As socioeconomically suppressed communities, having to fight against people with deep pockets and have all the money in the world to come in and destroy our lands. That's what we've been fighting to protect for a very long time.
Tribal leaders are also calling on President Biden to designate one more national monument in California before the end of his term. This week, Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland shared her perspective about the agency's Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative and President Joe Biden's apology to Indian country. In a blog post on the Interior Department's website, Haaland says, of all the work in the department under the Biden-Harris administration, one of the most significant, she says, has been the boarding school initiative, which she launched in 2021. Haaland shares thoughts about her own family history with the Indian boarding schools. A day ahead of Biden's apology, Haaland told National Native News she's been personally impacted.
Decades ago, when I was sitting at my grandmother's kitchen table and talking to her about boarding schools, she didn't tell me everything, right? I knew there was more to what she was telling me.
Haaland says she still feels the impact of injustices on her ancestors, including that her great-grandpa, being more than 100 miles away from his daughter's boarding school, only had a horse and wagon.
He was able to only visit her twice during the 5 years that she was there. Her time there, her dad's time at boarding school, that affected my life. And I didn't realize how much it affected my life right until I got a little bit older.
Haaland's boarding school initiative included an investigative report and a listening tour across Indian country. President Biden traveled to a tribal community in Arizona in October, where he formally apologized to Native Americans and Alaska Natives. In December, President Biden established the Carlisle Federal Indian Boarding School National Monument. In the blog post, Haaland says the work is not finished, but she also talks about healing. The Pennington County Commission in South Dakota has approved a statue commemorating the search for justice for missing and murdered Indigenous peoples. The statue, created by the Red Ribbon Skirt Society, will be installed outside the county administration building. The base of the statue's plaque reads, "And her name shall be Justice." The small-scale mock-up of the statue features a woman in traditional regalia holding an eagle feather. Artist Rachel Berg of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is creating the statue. The Red Ribbon Skirt Society has raised about half of the statue's cost and hopes to install it by summer. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org. See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Our system gets overwhelmed very, very quickly. And the easiest thing to do when it's overwhelmed is to kind of kick the can down the road and delay, delay, delay.
Anchorage's court system is delaying rulings for years, even for open and shut cases. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 8th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a man accused of firing into a North Anchorage home is shot by local police, their second in 24 hours.
Our officers immediately responded and fired rounds at the suspect, striking the suspect multiple times.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Anchorage officers shot a man early this morning after police say he shot a homeowner in the Government Hill neighborhood. Both the man and homeowner were hospitalized and no officers were injured. It's the second police shooting in Anchorage in 24 hours. At a press conference, Police Chief Sean Case said 911 dispatchers received six different calls at around 6 a.m. from people reporting shots fired in the 700 block of Hollywood Drive. Two of the callers were a woman and a man inside the house that a male suspect had allegedly fired rounds into. Case says the two believed the suspect was trying to break in. He says officers arrived on scene and started interviewing witnesses while the man and woman inside the home were still on the phone with dispatchers.
About that time, officers observed a male suspect. The suspect did have a long gun, unsure right now if it was a rifle or a shotgun. Started to give commands and the suspect disappeared out of sight around the victim residence.
Case says the man inside the home then walked outside and officers immediately told him to get it back inside the house.
As that was happening, the suspect then appeared in the front of the house as well. And fired at the victim, striking him multiple times. As that was happening, our officers immediately responded and fired rounds at the suspect, striking the suspect multiple times.
Case says both the suspect and victim were taken to the hospital with what he described as critical injuries. He says it's unknown if the victim and suspect knew each other. He says the number of rounds fired by two APD officers is also unknown due to crossfire. The officers were placed on administrative leave per APD policy. This police shooting comes less than 24 hours after an officer shot an armed robbery suspect in Midtown. That suspect was critically injured and remains hospitalized. Last year, APD officers shot eight people, killing five of them. Case declined to describe the higher-than-normal number of police shootings as a trend.
These are all independent incidents with the own set of circumstances and facts that surround them. And, you know, the officers go into each one of these scenarios, dealing with them each individually.
Charges haven't been filed yet against either suspect, but he anticipates some in the future. Case says he expects to provide additional details on both shootings in the coming days. In Anchorage, some felony cases are taking years to resolve, despite a state law mandating trials occur within 120 days after someone is charged. In a recent investigative story, Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica journalist Kyle Hopkins found that those deadlines are rarely being met. And in some cases, trials are being delayed for so long that accusers die before justice can be served. A centerpiece to the reporting is a sexual assault from 2017, which Hopkins says had all the hallmarks of an open and shut case.
One reason we were looking at that case was it seemed like one that would be resolved fairly quickly because you had multiple witnesses and you had DNA evidence. It was a broad daylight sexual assault of two people. It was witnessed by a woman who called 911 and was describing, kind of in real time, was describing this sexual assault occurring. So, you know, jurors could hear her, the recording of her saying, you know, this man is raping this woman right now. It's happening right now. I'm watching it, right? And then police arrived pretty quickly. And so you have a couple police officers who are on the scene, and you have one who actually picks the suspect or the defendant up off of one of the victims. And so he was able to testify. And so just a lot of evidence. And it seems like it just struck me as the type of case that if one is going to be resolved fairly quickly, that would be it, right? It's not a he said, she said case. And the fact that there were two victims. And so I was just curious why a case like that would not be resolved, you know, in the first or second or third year or fourth year or fifth year. You know, COVID happened towards the end of that time frame, but most of those delays were, you know, pre-COVID.
That case happened 7 years before a verdict was reached in December. What happened there? And did you find that it's indicative of a trend?
The way that this case speaks to a trend is that you have, you know, defense attorneys who are asking for many, many delays. You know, that there's one way that case can be resolved is if the defendant and the defense, they agree to a plea agreement. They agree to plead guilty, you know, usually to like a reduced charge. But if that doesn't happen, then the case has to go to trial. You know, we are guaranteed in Alaska by the state constitution that, you know, we will go to trial within 120 days of being arrested. And so unless you ask to delay the case, and what happens is in some of these cases, the defense will ask to delay the case again and again and again. And sometimes they'll say it's because they're negotiating for a plea deal. But other times no reason is given. And also often, you know, what it speaks to is that we just have a small number of criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors in the state and even judges who can handle, you know, are able to handle these trials. And so our system gets overwhelmed very, very quickly. And the easiest thing to do when it's overwhelmed is to kind of kick the can down the road and delay, delay, delay. And, you know, so year after year, suddenly you look at a case and it's been delayed, you know, 50 times, 70 times, you know, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. And that's not super unusual. We found many examples of that happening in Anchorage.
And you report that taking a long time to go to trial often benefits those who are accused of crimes, especially in some of the cases you note where the accusers have died. How are these delays continuing to persist?
Well, one thing we heard again and again, we heard it from prosecutors especially, is that, you know, a delay tends to benefit the defense because, you know, say it's been 5 years since the arrest happened. Well, you know, the police officer who made the arrest, that person might have retired. They might have moved out of state. They might not be available to testify anymore in front of a jury. The cases that we looked at involved victims who were unhoused, you know, and so kind of especially vulnerable. And when the case dragged on for 5 or 6 or 7 years or longer, they died. They died outdoors. You know, that is the life expectancy of someone unhoused in Anchorage is shorter than, you know, those of us who have housing. And if a case goes on long enough, the chances increase that that victim will die and will not be able to testify. And sometimes that victim is the only person who can testify, you know, to say lack of consent. And at that point, the case falls apart and the prosecutor is kind of forced to give a plea deal.
And what do you see as the solution here?
You know, one thing I've heard from like retired judges is that we need to be careful about how we try and solve these problems because say we start to rush every case to trial, you know, that doesn't benefit anyone. That's, you know, if the defense attorney doesn't have enough time to kind of, you know, adequately prepare for trial, then maybe that case, you know, is not handled correctly and then gets reversed, you know, whatever happens gets reversed on appeal. I think there's a danger in overcorrecting and then kind of forcing everything to go to trial too quickly. And that also is problematic. So, you know, I think one thing I think they could consider is they could look at maybe not having like pre-indictment hearings in Anchorage. There's some of these like types of hearings that are early on after someone's arrested, where it's really likely that the case is just going to get kicked down the road and no one's really explaining why, right? So it could be that maybe judges would, especially in Anchorage, would kind of demand that defense attorneys and prosecutors really good give a good reason for a delay, you know, and kind of hold their feet to the fire, and then, you know, set cases for trials rather than, you know, just automatically, you know, accept every request for a delay.
Kyle Hopkins is a reporter with the Anchorage Daily News. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, St. Paul residents work to protect the abundant marine life around the remote Bering Sea Island.
Nobody else is going to come in and save the day, so we feel the need to take it upon ourselves to do something about, you know, the downturn of the ecosystem in our backyard.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance? United Way Healthcare Navigators are here to help you understand your coverage and saving options and enroll in a plan at healthcare.gov. The help is free, unbiased, and confidential. Language interpretation is available. Call 211 to connect to free local navigator assistance. For coverage starting January 1st, you must enroll by December 15th. This message sponsored by United Way of Anchorage.
A man held at the Anchorage Correctional Complex has died after authorities say his cellmate severely beat him. Alaska State Troopers say 36-year-old William Farmer died Monday at a local hospital. 33-year-old Lawrence Fanumiai is now charged with second-degree murder in his death. Megan Edge with the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska is raising concerns. It's the second reported homicide at the Anchorage jail in a year.
One in a year would be unusual. Two in a year is exceptionally unusual and very concerning.
Charging documents say that on the night of December 17th, a correctional officer saw Fanumiai on top of Farmer in their cell, punching him in the head. More officers arrived and removed Fanumiai. Medics then took Farmer to the hospital with brain swelling. Fanumiai allegedly said that Farmer had been talking to himself and that he attacked Farmer to make him stop. Edge says the two men shouldn't have been in the cell together that day in the first place. According to court records, Fanumiai was initially jailed on assault charges from an incident in Juneau. He was evaluated at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, found incompetent to stand trial, and ordered back to Juneau 4 days before he allegedly attacked Farmer in the Anchorage cell. Edge is questioning why he didn't get moved.
What happened in the system that left him stuck in Anchorage and not transported back to Juneau when the charges were dropped?
The State Department of Corrections didn't answer that question directly. Officials said today that, quote, the safety and security of all individuals housed in any of our facilities is our top priority. They added that department staff evaluate all major incidents at DOC facilities alongside investigations by troopers. Fanumiai is being held today at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. Anchorage residents won't vote on a sales tax proposal in the next municipal election. At a meeting yesterday, the Anchorage Assembly postponed voting on the proposed ballot measure and instead passed a resolution calling for a special election later this year. Vice Chair Meg Zalatel proposed the resolution. She said she thinks the Assembly needs more time to continue the conversation.
When this item came before the Assembly, I remember the chair clearly saying, I wish we had 6 months for this conversation. I'm trying to create some of that space.
The Assembly still needs to vote to hold a special election on the sales tax, which would happen before November 30th. The original version was introduced in October and proposes a 3% sales tax in the city. Last month, Assembly members put forward 4 additional variations of the proposal, offering changes to the tax percentage and how revenues would be spent. The original proposal is estimated to generate $180 million annually, and revenue would go towards reducing property taxes and funding public projects. Supporters say the tax would allow Anchorage to invest in itself, while critics say it would disproportionately impact low-income residents. Assemblymember Anna Brawley says holding a special election would give assembly members the opportunity to fine-tune a final proposal and allow the public to learn and understand the details.
I think it is important to continue working through this, so I'm not advocating that we take months and months on this. I'm asking for a few extra weeks. I think within 60 days from now or less, we could come up with a proposal.
The resolution passed 7-5. Assembly members will hear public testimony at the regular meeting on March 4th. Meanwhile, five schools are on the chopping block in the Fairbanks North Scarborough School District. They are Hunter, Midnight Sun, Pearl Creek, Salcha, and Two Rivers Elementary Schools. District administrators announced the list when they delivered their proposed consolidation plan Monday night at a Board of Education work session. KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist was there and has this report.
The Fairbanks North Scarborough School District is having to deal with a handful of numerical realities, including budgetary shortfalls, declining enrollment, and underused space in elementary schools. Last spring, that led the district to begin the process for selecting schools to propose for closure. Chief Operating Officer Andrew DeGraw says arriving at those selections involved weighing variables like the condition of facilities, impact to transportation routes, current staff vacancies, and school geography. Monday marked the start of the latest phase in that process, with administrators releasing the plan that recommends shuttering one elementary school in each of five regions in the borough: the Southeast, Northeast, West, North Pole, and Central Fairbanks regions.
As we looked at geography, we wanted to ensure that we didn't close too many schools in one area of our district to where there would be too many students in closed schools for adjacent schools to take.
If the board opts to close all five elementary schools, administrators expect to save about $7 million annually for the first couple years and about $5 million each year after that. In combination with the $3 million the district expects to retain by contracting custodial work, the closures would take a $10 million bite out of the projected budget deficit of between $8 million and $32 million. Administrators can't say exactly what the deficit will be right now because the district budget largely depends on what funding the school system receives from the state and the Fairbanks North Star Borough, which can fluctuate as the governments hammer out their own budgets. Beyond savings, the consolidation plan also targets increasing the number of students relative to each school's capacity. And Superintendent Luke Meinert says the district should consider offloading schools even if the budget picture brightens with additional funding from the state or borough.
I think we should still be at the table talking about school consolidations because of the loss of enrollment and the potential of reinvestment back in our schools to lower class sizes, add back music, and do some of these things that we wanted to do.
According to district data, enrollment has dropped by more than 2,100 students in the last 20 years, but the number of school buildings has increased over that same period. DeGraw told the board Monday that schools ideally reach 85% or more of enrollment capacity, but that, on average, district elementary schools are currently at about 67%. Under the consolidation plan, the redistribution of students is projected to increase the rate to between 77 and 95% at the remaining elementary schools. And using an archery metaphor, DeGraw says that just about exhausts the options for consolidation.
The arrows in the quiver are pretty much gone. If the board accepts the recommendation of the administration and closes five schools, we can all see the capacity levels that we see. There's not five more schools that we can close. They're not there.
The board didn't cast final votes on the consolidation plan Monday, and they won't until February 4th. Between now and then, the board has two more work sessions scheduled for January 13th and January 27th, as well as public listening sessions scheduled for January 16th and January 22nd. In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. You can make a difference in the lives of Alaskans. Every year, hundreds of nonprofits provide warm meals, safe places, and resources to hundreds of thousands of Alaskans. By supporting Alaska's nonprofits when you apply for your PFD, you're giving more opportunity, more hope, more chances. This year, make more possible with the click of a button. Don't forget to give via PicClick Give when you apply for your PFD. This message sponsored by PicClick Give.
More than 1 million pounds of Alaska snow crab that might have previously gone unfished can now be processed thanks to an agreement between the cities of St. Paul and Onalaska. KUCB's Andy Lusk reports that the deal is a unique opportunity for collaboration and is expected to bring economic relief to St. Paul.
The Onalaska City Council unanimously approved a measure Friday that will allow snow crab, or opelio, normally processed by Trident Seafoods in St. Paul, to come to Onalaska instead. The agreement comes after Trident's announcement that they would not process the crab at their facility on the Pribilof Island.
We had the situation with no processor in the northern region for snow crab.
That's Onalaska Fisheries Advisor Frank Kelty noting that without the St. Paul Trident plant, there's no processor to handle the portion of the harvest referred to as North Region snow crab. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game allotted harvesters a total catch of more than 4.5 million pounds this season. That gets split up among boats, processors, and communities through a quota sharing system. This season, crabbers were set to deliver almost a third of that total catch to the North Region at St. Paul's Trident plant. But Trident pulled out, saying the amount was too low to justify opening the plant, which they've touted as the largest snow crab processing facility in the world. That left the crab with nowhere to go, and it would have otherwise been left in the ocean. That is, until Friday's special city council meeting. Here's Onalaska City Attorney Charles Cassiola.
Crab that would otherwise need to be landed in St. Paul could instead be landed and processed in Onalaska.
Onalaska City Council members voted to give the City of St. Paul its normal seafood tax for all of the North Region crab landed locally. St. Paul will also receive state fisheries business tax from the same catch.
The harvesters would pay St. Paul's 3.5% rather than Onalaska's 2% on crab that is North Region designated.
The agreement would net St. Paul the same fish tax revenue as if the crab were processed there. Still, the city says Onalaska should see a sales tax revenue bump and increased economic activity for the delivery and processing of the extra crab. The contract could provide significant economic relief to the Pribilof Island community, which has historically relied on crab as a major stream of revenue. St. Paul city officials have estimated that they're missing out on about $3 million in tax revenue due to the fishery closures. The city has lost more than 24 employees in the last 3 years, and they've had to increase utility rates and take money from savings to stay afloat. The tax revenue from the small snow crab harvest could provide a much-needed bump to the community. Onalaska city officials say they're glad for the unique opportunity to help out the island's distant neighbor to the north. Kelty says Unicy and Westward, two Onalaska processors, can now take St. Paul's crab landings. The exemption agreement is active through the end of June. In Onalaska, co-reporting with Maggie Nelson, I'm Andy Lusk.
The Aleut community of St. Paul is moving forward with a new conservation plan for its local environment. It's after encountering pushback on a proposed federally managed National Marine Sanctuary. As the Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee reports, this alternative would prioritize local and traditional knowledge in managing the island's rich marine resources.
It's hard to spend time in the Bering Sea village of St. Paul without thinking about fur seals. Their barking echoes from nearly every corner of the Ununga village. But for longtime resident Zanita Melavidov, it's not like it used to be.
They're all declining. I remember rookeries used to be millions, thousands in every rookery around the island, all full of seals. Now it's empty.
Everyone around the village knows Melavidov as Grandma Z. She grew up in St. Paul when the local economy relied on the fur seal harvest, and she worked in the blubbering shop. Even back then, the community was worried about the future.
My mom and dad used to talk about this years ago. Whenever I was young, I didn't understand. Now I know. No more seals, no more food, no more birds.
The island sits just 30 miles from the eastern Bering Sea shelf, in an area that's rich with marine life, including fur seals, fish, and birds. And since last fall, the tribal government, the Aleut community of St. Paul, has been holding listening events with the community to create a plan to protect the island's ecosystems from threats like climate change and overfishing. Destiny Bristol Cushion works with the tribe's Ecosystem Conservation Office. She says they plan to designate the waters around St. Paul Island as an Indigenous Marine Stewardship Area,
which essentially gives the power to the people in the community, and it gives us the opportunity to incorporate traditional knowledge into decision-making within this protected area.
This is the community's second attempt at ensuring protections around the island. Back in 2022, the tribe announced its plans for a similar federal designation, known as a National Marine Sanctuary. It would have been the first in Alaska, and given the tribal government a seat at the table with state and federal resource managers. But the proposal faced resistance.
We're kind of just taking a step back because it wasn't very accepted.
Commercial fishing groups voiced strong opposition to the proposal when it was nominated in 2022, and regional communities like Unalaska, whose economies rely on fishing, opposed the sanctuary. Cushion says even some community members within St. Paul were concerned that it would jeopardize local fishing.
People think, oh, federal and state governments would have the power and they could just regulate my fishing or their fishing. Or it's more of just like a fear. And it's because fishing is a big part of our history. And so you don't really want to lose that.
The National Marine Sanctuary Act explicitly states that fisheries management bodies, like the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, would still have final authority. And the tribe says the designation would not curtail commercial fishing. But that wasn't enough to calm critics. Tribal Council President John Wayne Melavidoff says the tribe finally decided in October to stop pushing for the sanctuary.
We didn't want to move forward with something that would be so controversial, right? And potentially tear people apart instead of bring them together.
The new focus on the Indigenous Marine Stewardship Area centers local leadership, with less federal and state government oversight. But it lacks the robust legal framework of a national marine sanctuary. The Indigenous-led designation is part of a newer program. The first one was created off the coast of California in 2023.
Nobody else is going to come in and save the day, so we feel the need to take it upon ourselves to do something about the downturn of the ecosystem in our backyard.
Details like boundaries and regulations haven't yet been finalized. Melavidoff says the tribe is working with community members to develop a cohesive plan, and community leaders involved with the project say local participation will be key. All that being said, the original plan is still not off the table. Both designations could coexist, and acceptance of a national marine sanctuary is now in the Fed's hands. They'll likely make a decision within the next 5 years. But the locals in St. Paul say they aren't waiting to develop a new Indigenous-led effort. In St. Paul, I'm Theo Greenlee.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint and Ava White in Anchorage, Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, Andy Luskin in Alaska, and Theo Greenlee in St. Paul. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
I used to hang out
down at Jack's Pool Hall. You go down there and don't do nothing at all. You wanted to play some cards, there was a game in the back. If you wanted a shot or something, you went out to Jack. If you had a little money, you was a grade A fool. There was a guy down there who used to shoot a little pool. Rack 'em up. Rack 'em up. Rack 'em up. Rack 'em up. They said he had a wife, but she left him in tears. He hadn't been home once in 25 years. Rack 'em up. Rack 'em up.
Spill milk. Give me a paper towel. Give me another. you. Why you bother me when you know you don't want me? Why you bother me when you know you got a woman? Why you hitting me when you know better? Know you know better. Know you grew better than you do. Got me looking for you. I be looking for you. Got me looking forward to weekends.
Say something, speak up for yourself. They think you stupid. You know what I'm saying?
Yesterday he said my eyes were fading fast away. I said, well, what do you expect? They asked me not to stay. And if it had all been for the best, I wouldn't feel this way, he said. Oh, he said. This one.
Love me like you do, love, love. that's all I do. And if you saw
how I'm in love with her. I'm slanging work on the curb, hustling drugs with her. The jet vibe, 50 million, you want to feel it. She, I'm high as a motherfucker. Don't have me f***ing make me lie to you, motherfucker. Man, truth is for real, feel like Dre for real. Mixed with Eric B and Rakim, shout it hell on the scale. It's still the game enticing me, like every time I see her. And like a papa seal, high enough to see her live, for real. And man, I know all the chill, you don't know how good it make a nigga feel. Come on. Kick it, play, super flout. Don't need a grand to get laid, an ounce to get paid. You kush to roll up, a drink to blow up. Anyone know us, they know trash. It in our DNA and numbers on the need to know basis. This ain't no Q&A. I promise traded, I put the game on lock and ain't no taking that back. Put it on everything I got. Up at the door, hopping out of lane. Residential areas flying, I'm getting out of damn. Ma'am, tell your son he better watch it, cause we rolling. And disrespect is not an option in my neighborhood. So why are you talking to me? Even though we know you hating, then that's all it could be. Cause if I call on them all, it's indebted to me. If I ain't your S.O.D., then it could be.
watch it, call it that old thing. Blowing gasoline to put my hat on. Lane where I stay, all they did, poop, Trump all day. Two or three pistol little with me, AI Ray. She brought a four kush to me and a six pack. Okay, well, I'm about to roll it up and hit that. Then I'ma make her wipe me down like a wet sink. Ride it like a jet ski. Pass it to me, yes, bitch. Hey. I'm telling you, man, if you can get the high I'm on, I mean, when it got me blow, man, I swear. Drake, where you get this, man? Yeah, from the west side on, man. You get it? All right.
The Yunga Tribal Council is a proud sponsor of KSDP and Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting. Thank you for your support.
Caps wouldn't be